Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 184.
This week on the podcast, Bernie Sanders, a man who got the most debate time at this week's Democratic debate.
Hillary Clinton, a woman who won't let experience stop her from misunderstanding things.
Iran's prisoner release includes a mystery man that Wolf Blitzer just learned of.
Plus, the State of the Union reveals that Paul Ryan is a member of the elusive pro-cancer caucus.
And Ted Cruz and all of New York City have a very different sense of what New York values consist of.
Flint, Michigan's water situation is just another kind of state violence against black people.
And have a happy MLK Day, America. Related, have a terrible Robert E. Lee Day, Arkansas. Or better yet, just don't have one at all.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right. Do that, and then settle in, because this is the week of weeks.
We just left our Bernie Sanders debate watch party.
Meetup, yes.
It was the most predictable collection of people that you would imagine or would be at a Bernie Sanders watch party in West Hollywood.
That's right.
It was lovely
people.
Lovely people.
Interesting people.
All the people.
But a good time.
A good time.
And they knew when to applaud and when to jeer.
And there was someone there who really knew when to applaud, because she didn't once let us down when it came to a chance to applaud.
There was also a woman, I think it may have been the same woman, who also knew every moment where she was supposed to say, "Shut up, bitch!"
So true. She was really the highlight of our debate watching experience.
Yeah. And you know what? Every time she said it, I silently said to myself,
"Shut up, bitch."
That's right. You go, girl.
We're trying to use not as many gendered insults for Hillary Clinton.
I'm not.
Because we're trying to insult her on the issues.
I know. Exactly.
We're trying to insult her because she has bad ideas.
Right.
So we're trying to use the term asshole to describe her now on.
P.S. Yes.
If you catch us, we're sorry about it.
Yeah.
I just realized, I was finally like, listen, I dislike Hillary Clinton not because I think she's a bitch. She's actually lovely. I dislike her because she's an asshole.
Yeah. Well, she's dead to me.
And she's dead to Brent this week. You guys, Brent texted me earlier in the week with a slew of angry things to say about Hillary Clinton. He was not kidding around. This is the week that broke the camel's back in terms of Brent and Hillary Clinton's friendship.
It happened. I mean, I have obviously, you know, we've had years on this podcast of disagreeing with her on policy. And there have been moments going all the way back to when she was, you know, voting for the Iraq war and I was mad, or, you know, being what I thought was, you know, not a great candidate in 2007 and 2008. But I have always had my moments of, I generally disagree with her on a lot of things, but I'm handling her in just sort of like a general sense of the, like, she doesn't make my stomach churn and incite blind rage. And this week,
might have voted for her in the general if it came up.
I might have.
Right. That was,
I was
still
already
on the table.
He was on the fence.
He said that on the podcast before. But he was on the fence enough to think, to consider it. This week, that's off the table.
The sight of her face repulses me.
Brent is not kidding around this week.
And I don't know. I don't, like, I don't know what else to say.
No, there was, but, we're in a bit of a fury situation when it comes to Hillary Clinton.
Fury.
Because of a thing that happened this week. So we,
as
you know, we've been saying for years that we don't think she's a good candidate. We've been saying for years that we disagree with her on a slew of issues.
Yes.
One thing that we hadn't yet had the chance to say for years was that she repulsed us, the very sight of her. And that is because it was not until this week that she decided to turn her back on the healthcare proposal that she has been talking about for the last million years.
Yes. It was the most disingenuous and deceitful. And, I mean, she was lying, is what she was doing.
Here's
the
background. Bernie Sanders is catching up to her in the polls.
That's right.
She's panicking because, as we're about to talk
about, we're going to get to those polls.
Her campaign doesn't understand what's going on. That's been clear for a while now, but this was the week where I think they were like, holy fuck.
Yeah.
So, earlier in the week, they send Chelsea Clinton out.
Yeah, and we talked about that a little bit last week, and we were mad about it. But we weren't expecting the doubling and tripling and quadrupling down.
We thought they would be like, no, 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 we didn't mean it that way.
No.
We love every blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Here's what happened instead. Hillary Clinton doubled down on the idea that Bernie Sanders is out to destroy healthcare. Her new sort of platform is that Bernie Sanders, in proposing Medicare for All, is aiming to unrealistically dismantle Obamacare.
That's right.
And we shouldn't have ideas
He's
anymore.
He's going to remove millions of people from their health insurance.
Right.
By dismantling Obamacare. And then he's going to raise middle-class taxes to the point where it bankrupts you to implement single-payer healthcare
system. Here are the things she didn't tell you. One, that in raising your taxes to pay for single-payer, you will no longer have the cost of a premium to a private insurance company.
Yes.
So you will actually save money overall.
Yes. Bernie Sanders said tonight at the debate that it would save you $5,000. That, even to me, seems like a lot. PolitiFact has looked at this, and they said anywhere between $5 and $1,200 it would save the average American.
Yeah.
Because I think his proposal, actually, which he, you know...
He released just hours before the debate.
Bless his heart. I think he wanted to make sure that she couldn't say he hadn't released his plan yet, because that's another thing that she's been saying.
Yeah.
I think it's like something like a 2.2% tax or something like that. And there's also an employer tax as well, because employers, at least currently,
pay a large portion of your health insurance anyway.
And she knows how deceitful she's being. Yeah. She knows.
This is her wheelhouse. She has for years.
She's using all of the GOP talking points to take down all of his plans. How much your taxes are going to go up, how much all of these plans are going to cost. She's been doing that for a while. She's been talking about this $15 trillion number, which the Wall Street Journal printed a long time ago, which has been refuted by any economist worth their weight who has math skills. And she doesn't care, because what she's doing right now is the polls are closed, and she's trying to scaremonger up enough votes, and it's...
Brent is without words.
I've lost my words.
Yeah, no.
This makes me so mad.
This is the week that Hillary Clinton became unacceptable.
That's right.
To us.
Yeah.
For a long time, and I've been saying for a long time, like, I think I reached the point where I was not going to vote for her in the general. We live in California. There is not a decision for us to make about whether or not our vote will impact the outcome of the general.
Right.
It won't. So we can vote for whoever the fuck we want in California. So I'm going to vote for Jill Stein if Bernie Sanders isn't.
That's right.
And like, fuck it. What do I care?
Nope.
What does California care? What does anyone care? You know? Doesn't matter. And I mean, there are issues when someone like me has decided that they cannot in good conscience vote for the party. That's an issue. That's an issue in terms of, I'm someone who talks about politics all
day
long.
She's talking like a Republican to try and tear down an issue that Democrats have been working on for decades.
Decades. And she was a part of this movement.
Yes.
Not
she's been working on it for
she's
decades.
She's been working on this for decades. This is a part of our platform. This is a part of our platform going back to when Medicare was first installed. This is a part of our platform that is sort of one of the most basic and intrinsic things that you associate with the democratic principles. This is the ideal for all of us.
Like, yes.
It is not... It is one... You know, the Clintons have moved very far away from the original Democratic platform and have been for years. They are essentially moderate Republicans. We've been saying that for a long time.
Yep.
We know it. But this is not really an acceptable thing to pick a fight over for us. It's one thing when no one on the left was saying, hold on a minute, single payer is the way to go.
Yep.
It's one thing, though, when the person who is claiming that her expertise in this race is in healthcare...
To lie about it to people to scare up votes.
That's not acceptable.
It's not acceptable.
In any case, you will not hear that Brain Trust Live is voting for Hillary Clinton out of a sense of obligation.
Under no circumstance.
This is not a podcast of people who are voting for Hillary
Clinton. And if I ever think that I'm going to, tell me. Episode 184.
Episode 184 was the one.
To go back.
We definitively declared.
Re-listen and remind
yourself. That we were a no on Hillary. A no on Hillary.
Anyway, the debate was fun.
The debate was fun.
Now that I got that off my chest, I'm sure I'm going to come back to it in a little bit.
The thing that was the most exciting thing about the debate was that Bernie Sanders really hit campaign finance reform hard. And if you've been listening to this podcast, you know that we've said in the past that that is the only issue.
That is what I keep saying. And it took me actually longer than I even sort of want to admit to myself to get there. Because I that's why I love Bernie so much, because I feel like he is who got me there.
Yeah.
Because I've realized that we needed to do campaign finance reform because, like, the amount of money in politics is ridiculous, but I have never been able to sort of couple money in politics with not getting anything done in Congress.
Yeah.
And he has sort of, like, very clearly made that connection in a way that I think is clear to people, and he did it on a ton of issues tonight, more than I think he really ever has. He brought back so many issues to that. He brought back, you know, he brought back healthcare to that issue. He brought back, you know, the war to that issue. Yeah. He kept going back to it.
Well, that is the issue that is the mother of every other issue.
It is.
It's the mother issue.
Because you can debate about gun control until the cows come home, but when 90% of the country wants you to do background checks, but nobody will do it because they're taking NRA money, then that's the problem.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, Republicans, Democrats are fighting it about it. It's because they're getting money to win their next election.
And one thing I thought was really disingenuous that was part of the healthcare conversation was that Hillary Clinton kept claiming that she had stood up to insurance companies, when in fact, the very reason her healthcare proposal in the 90s failed was because she capitulated to them.
Right. And Obamacare capitulates to them.
And Obamacare capitulates to them,
it
too.
It forces you to buy private health insurance.
It forces you to buy health insurance. And because of that, she cannot say that she is for a single-payer healthcare system, because she has money in her pocket that came from the people who would lose their money if she were to actually institute that.
You know who else has that money too, which is really upsetting?
Howard fucking Dean.
Howard Dean.
Come on.
Who's a Clinton shill, I realize, but do you know what he did this week? Got a new job at a healthcare lobbying company and has been railing against Bernie Sanders' single payer system.
Yeah.
This is what that's the only proof you need to see that money
is what's corrupting
ruins
this.
It all.
Money is what's corrupting this process. By the way, this issue, I mean, this is sort of like one of our pet issues, I think. We talk a lot about healthcare.
Yeah.
And we, this week, have been sort of like walking around in a blind rage because of this Clinton situation has gone so bad so quickly.
I'm literally, if you're wondering what I'm doing right now, I'm hugging myself and like rocking back and forth, like in a way that a person who would need a padded wall would be doing. Like that's where I'm at with this.
Yeah. Well, and I think this debate that we just watched sort of further confirmed because that was the part of the debate that I literally threw my hands up in the air and was like, Brent, I need you to tweet for this part.
I know, you did. Yes, you did.
I literally reached a point where I was in a blind rage.
I know.
And I, like, couldn't... But I was also in a blind rage. I was both, like, angry tweeting and telling Brent I couldn't think straight enough to tweet while I was tweeting the tweets that I shouldn't have tweeted about how angry I was. And then, like, throwing my hand... I, like, threw my phone up into the air at one point and was like, I've had enough. Yeah. Because this line of conversation is sort of been the story of this week.
Yes.
It is the story of a flailing campaign that can't figure out where to find their footing, looking for a way to destroy a campaign that doesn't play this game.
Right.
And that's kind of what we saw at the debate. Yeah. We saw a lot of Hillary Clinton's a good debater. She keeps her calm. She's good at coming up with ways to attack people that are sort of relevant to the conversation, and she's good at spinning things so that they seem like they're making a point that they're not making.
Oh, yeah.
But she did that very sort of like visibly this in a lot of these cases. You know, it's hard to attack Bernie Sanders on issues because if he disagrees with you on something, he won't pretend like he agrees with you. He'll be like, no, I think we just disagree on this point.
Yeah.
So you can't attack him for believing things he doesn't believe, because he just says what he believes.
Right.
And he doesn't have any, like, secret belief that he's not talking about. So she has to spin things to attack him. And that's kind of what was happening with the healthcare conversation.
Yeah.
She had to really spin the conversation, and he had to keep being like, you're misrepresenting everything, and you know it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the farthest he got into attacking her.
Yeah.
But every other time he would just be like, no, I just think we disagree on this.
Yeah.
This is a point where we disagree.
Yeah.
And that's a hard person to debate against, but it also kind of put her in an even more desperate seeming light a lot of the time, because even as she's very polished at these debates, she was in a room of establishment people. So she was getting a good applause, and
she was,
you know, she was together. She looked like she was together.
Well, and she did a lot of smart things in that debate. I mean, she went after Bernie, and even in the healthcare bill, she did it. I mean, it was causing you and I to go in a blind rage, but just the way that she did it in the room,
it was a cleverly constructed
argument. It was cleverly
argument.
Constructed because she was talking about, like, you know, how he wanted to, you know, dismantle Obama's, you know, she kept tying things back to, like, Obama and how Bernie wanted
Obama's
to do that. And
legacy.
We know that, you know, this was the debate that was sponsored by the Black Caucus in South Carolina, which has a lot of African-American voters and which already like her. I mean, she knew sort of where her applause lines were. And that's because she's not an idiot.
Right.
And so on that level, I think that she did a good job. But she also did a good job on being, you know, a lying fearmonger, you know, using GOP talking points.
A lot of GOP talking points going around.
Yeah.
A lot of GOP talking points.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like a lot of... When he got in a good line about her taking money from Goldman Sachs, too, I think that the defining issue of this campaign has been income inequality, and she cannot address that issue. She cannot compete on that issue. No. She doesn't really even try.
Well, even Joe Biden this week, who you would think would be in the Clinton corner on some level, talked about how Bernie Sanders was like really good at talking about this, and Clinton wasn't quite as good because she was new to the discussion on this.
Yeah.
And that's correct.
That's a correct statement. And poor Martin O'Malley.
I know.
It's he had to introduce himself again at the beginning of the debate.
My name is Martin O'Malley. Like, don't... That can't be...
Too late.
2 weeks before the first election. Like, you can't be telling people what your name is.
He was the Jim Webb of this debate. He had to be in the corner being like, but what about if I wanted to answer?
And he did a good job. Yeah. But, like...
Because he's sort of, at this point, acting like Bernie Sanders' hype man.
I know.
He's
exactly.
He's there to attack Hillary Clinton on the issues that Bernie doesn't necessarily want to attack her on directly until someone else has started the conversation.
Or to be sort of, like, just, like, a second voice. Like, there was a moment where, like, they were talking about, you know, breaking up big banks.
Yeah.
And Sanders went on, you know, talked about reinstating Glass-Steagall, you know, too big to fail, blah, 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 went on this whole thing. And then Hillary Clinton attempted to say that she believed all the same things that Hillary Clinton...
And Martin O'Malley...
That Bernie Sanders does. And Martin O'Malley was immediately there
with He interrupted her, like, three times.
Hang on just a second. Like,
he interrupted
not...
her three times and with things like, that's a lie. That's he would just, like, monotone, that's a lie, into the mic.
Yeah, exactly. But then he finally got a chance to speak, and he was like, you know, with all due respect, like, you do
we
not...
We don't agree on this
We
issue.
Don't agree on this.
Yeah.
And, like, there were a few moments like that where, you know... I think a while ago, I was like, God, I really wish Martin O'Malley wasn't there, because I think it would be great to have a one-on-one debate with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. But on some level, I kind of like having him there.
I like having him there, too.
Because it turns into a two-on-one situation at a certain point, and like, I like that. Yeah. I like those odds. Those are better odds.
Exactly. Well, and I feel like I'm excited that Martin O'Malley is not just sort of a general contrarian, because he really doesn't attack Sanders with the vehemence that he attacks Hillary Clinton, even though Sanders is kind of almost taking the lead at this point.
Yeah, you would...
You would think that he would just sort of be there to attack whoever, but he, because he's running so far to Clinton's left, he really, like, has to stick with Sanders on a lot of these points.
Yeah.
And he also, I think, knows that he doesn't have any support, but the ideas that he supports are popular.
Yes,
so he knows that he is representing a popular viewpoint in taking this position.
Yes.
It's just that someone else who's bigger has taken it first.
Right, exactly. Which, you know, a famous Brent Thornburg line. I feel bad for him.
That's right. Brent feels bad for everyone.
I really love to feel bad for everyone. I will never
feel
say
bad
that
for Hillary Clinton again ever again
about Hillary Clinton. And I've said it before.
Yeah.
If you think I haven't, I have. I know I have.
No, you have
many
times.
Probably 100 times.
You've said it every time that she's been trying to run for something and the Iraq War has come up again. And it's been like, really? Of all the things to come up for her, this had to come back to bite her again.
Really? I know.
Everything that she's ever done wrong has come back to bite her 1,000 times. Don't feel bad anymore.
Like, who would have thought in 2001 that in 2016 we were going to be talking about power vacuums that the Iraq War created ISIS with?
Not I.
Like that,
but,
you know,
here we are.
But here we are. And yes, you're right. I said that I felt bad for her for that. Not because she voted for it, because obviously I disagree with that vote.
No, that's just bad political
luck.
But,
like, that's just bad political luck.
And it's too bad. She deserved it.
Exactly. That's it.
She deserved it.
Never again will I feel bad for the woman.
Nope.
Sorry about it.
Sorry about it. Not that sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. Yeah, exactly.
In any case, there was a big article in the New York Times this week about how her campaign dramatically underestimated the Sanders campaign and the Sanders movement.
Well, this
was
kind
of interesting.
And this is another thing, because even...
This is a lesson she never learned.
This is... Exactly. And, you know, we'll get into sort of some of the nitty-gritty about this. But, you know, the other thing that I will... Just going back to sort of the rage that you and I were feeling about the health care issue this week, I think besides the fact that it, you know, should madden all Democrats, it should also give you pause about what kind of candidate she is.
Yeah.
Because this is sort of the first, you know, actual challenge with some of these polls that have come out this week where it looks like she could actually lose. And she reacted like a lunatic.
Yeah. Immediately she went full lunatic.
And if you think that she's not going to get more insane attacks from Donald Trump, who it looks more like is going to be the nominee, which is insane. We'll get to that in a little bit. But, I mean, you know, she's... If the way that she's going to react to, A, a close election, and B, you know, someone going after her a little bit, which he didn't even really do.
No,
she went after him.
Went after him, and he's just going after her by existing.
Right, exactly. If her response to that is going to be, mass hysteria, then that's not a candidate that you want running in the general election.
But this is a problem that she has. She had it in 2008.
Yeah.
This is the kind of candidate that she is. She likes to run on her own inevitability. That's an easy position to have when you are the inevitable candidate. You don't have to do anything. She spent months of this campaign not even really appearing in public at the beginning, and that was because she wanted to maintain this sort of aloof quality that made her inevitable.
Yeah.
Now that she's in an actual campaign, the thing that we're learning is that she can't be in a close race and make good decisions.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. You know, you would want this article that we're going to talk about right now actually is, you know, it interviewed 11 different people who of course spoke on, you know, the condition of anonymity, but they were all either current Clinton staffers or friends of Clinton who sort of, you know, have information, donors, and they were all basically saying that she did not learn any of the lessons of 2007 and 2008.
Yeah.
So she, she and Bill both are upset that they didn't deal with him earlier. They underestimated. Exactly. It's not a word. They underestimated Sanders to begin with. They feel like they made miscalculations by not going after him earlier and ignoring him. And that's exactly what they did with Obama.
When I saw Bill Clinton on Stephen Colbert's The New Show.
Oh, yeah. He didn't get it.
And I said, this is something that concerns me. He should understand what's happening here. He is acting like this is a fake fringe thing that doesn't matter. And it really does matter for them. They need to address it. Yep. And he didn't know how to address it without sounding dismissive of Sanders voters.
Yep.
And that's the Sanders voters are his base.
Yeah.
So if he sounds dismissive of them, they're not going to go vote for Hillary after that.
Yeah.
That they have understood. They have not understood what's been going on.
Yeah. No, they haven't.
Possibly because they don't. They're not on Twitter.
Perhaps.
I feel like if they can't operate fax machines, it's clear that they're not up to date on all the greatest social media technology.
Right. And there, these same people who were interviewed say that the campaign has a huge fear, and this fear is totally founded because we're going to get some poll numbers that back this up, that Sanders is going to have a huge wave of first-time caucus goers that could derail her in Iowa in the same way that Obama did. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at least they get that.
Now. Only weeks before it matters.
And they are also becoming particularly concerned with her, quote, rational message, which I would say sort of is like what you said, the inevitable message.
Right.
That
the
where she was
vote
just
for
sort
me because I can win.
Right, exactly. Which she did in 2008, and she claimed she wasn't going to do this time. But in the words of one of her aides that was interviewed for this, that she's just not. That message is not fit for the sort of, you know, quote, restless Democratic primary electorate right now. And a lot of her allies and aides say that she is not connecting with voters through an emotional and inspiring rallying cry that Sanders is. And as you and I were discussing earlier,
2008 was a pre-Occupy world.
Right.
And it didn't even work then. But in a but this is a post-Occupy world where these voters were there. You could see them literally sleeping in the streets for months on end. We know who these voters are. It's not that kind of political campaigning. We were talking to some of these Bernie people today about how Bernie doesn't really have an organized national campaign force. He has like sort of individual campaign advisors in various places, but there's not like a big behemoth campaign office that's organizing all of these places. They're almost occupied. They're almost working on the Occupy model, where people are literally just expected to take initiative and do their own Bernie events and figure out their own Bernie stuff, and they kind of help coordinate them.
Yeah.
That kind of electorate is not looking for the rational message.
Right.
But that was obvious.
Well, and what, you know, and what you and I, when you and I were talking about this article earlier in the day, you know, I mean, she, I think, unfortunately for her, and this is another thing that concerns me in a general election, is that I don't think she has the ability to do this, to inspire people and to rally them behind her. I mean, certainly people will vote for her because they think that she's, you know, the best qualified or has the most experience or whatever. But that is not
the kind of candidate she is or ever has been.
No, and that's
what the Clinton brand represents anymore. It was what the Clinton brand represented when Bill Clinton was running for president the first time.
Right.
Because he was, quote, the first black president. Yeah. He was a guy who really had this sort of American dream story to back him up, and he was young and exciting and, you know, all of the things that Obama offered.
Yeah.
But that brand isn't her brand.
Yeah.
She doesn't have the ability to
No.
to become that brand because right. she is the ultimate insider. Right. There is no way for her to connect with these voters. She literally doesn't live in their world.
Yeah. Well, and she doesn't, and you and I were talking about this she's earlier in the week, actually. She's certainly not flying coach with them. When you and I were talking on whatever night it was this week, when I was sort of like
spiraling first
expressing my blind rage to you, I think that there is a sense among a lot of voters, and I certainly get the sense, and I got it this week a lot with her in seeing interviews with her and various other things, is that she doesn't act like she trusts, like, the general public, because she thinks that she has a right to this. And it almost comes off as, like, a disdain that she has for, like, you know, everyone who has chosen to not vote for her.
Well, and this,
like,
is something
that is not a way to inspire someone to vote for you. No, that's a way to inspire someone to vote for someone else.
That's the Debbie Wasserman Schultz model, too. I mean, when she talked about how millennial women are, you know, complacent because they've they've existed in a post-Roe world.
Right.
Here's the thing. We've talked about this before on the podcast. I've written about this in Huffington Post. Voters don't have to act rationally.
No.
They can do whatever the fuck they want.
That's right.
If they want to vote for you because your hair is blue, they can do that. You have to be the one who does outreach to them
right.
to explain to them why right. you can work for them.
Yes.
They don't have to decide that they work for you.
That's right.
So when she comes with almost the message that you work for her.
Exactly.
And she doesn't have to respond to your needs. If you think that corporate interests shouldn't be in politics, what the fuck does she care? That's on you. You should vote for her because she's the only one who can win, thanks to the corporate money. Like,
yep.
These are things that she doesn't sort of have. There's not like a two-way street with her campaign.
No.
She presents what she presents, and because it's supposedly the rational choice, you're supposed to just accept it.
Yeah.
And that isn't really a message that voters have to respond to, because there is someone who does sort of offer this kind of responsive, you know, discussion in the primary that they can go to instead. When there's not one of those people, then voters do have to make a choice about whether they want to support somebody who doesn't work for them.
Yeah.
But that's not a choice they have to make right now.
Yeah.
And they don't have to support you just because you think you're inevitable.
Yeah.
They don't even have to support you if you are inevitable.
Yeah.
They don't have to do anything.
Right.
They can just fucking wander around like lunatics and vote for whoever the fuck they want. This is the same thinking that derailed Christine Quinn in the mayoral race.
Totally.
We used that as a sort of parable for this race, and the same thing is happening.
Yeah, we wrote
about this.
There's a blog.
There's a blog about this. There's multiple blogs about this Hillary Clinton inevitability issue.
Yeah.
But
she
doesn't act like she works for us.
And these are not the only issues that she should have learned lessons from 2008, because she is also, they've terribly underestimated Sanders' appeal with independents and young people, and especially young women who Clinton, and you and I talked about this again as well, where she thinks that because she is a woman, that all women should be voting for her, and that's just not life.
You know what doesn't help women all that much? Is a world in which we can't pass any legislation that isn't approved by corporate overlords.
Well, right.
I mean, to assume, like, I would love to see a woman president.
Sure.
I keep a blog about soft sexism. I have some real things to say at the moment about how women are not treated fairly in this society.
Yeah.
And I was saying to Brent the other day, I would really love to be able to feel like I can support a woman who doesn't not believe any of the, like, I can't privilege that desire over things that I think really have tangible impacts on people's lives.
Right, exactly.
I would love if I could vote for Liz Warren right now. I would be thrilled. In a race between Bernie Sanders and Liz Warren where their other policies are identical, I'd love to be able to vote for a woman. I would do it in a heartbeat.
That's
not the world we live in.
Well,
I don't privilege, like, income inequality. I mean, I don't privilege being a woman over income inequality, over racial inequality, over any of the other inequalities. They all have to exist as discussions that we can have. Well, and she doesn't offer me that ability because she doesn't privilege income inequality over.
Well, and that's the thing. You have to
sponsorship.
You can't just, and you know, and I'm not saying she's not good on women's issues because I think that she has been good on women's issues.
But Sanders is good on women's issues too.
You know, I mean, I was talking to you about my mom, who is a Sanders supporter, and she wants nothing more than a woman to be president. No. My mother was a suffragette for Halloween, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a woman, my mother, who has always said that she would go to Washington, D.C. if there was an inauguration with a woman, and she is supporting Bernie Sanders right now because she understands that she, you know, that Sanders is just as good on women's issues and offers more beyond women's issues.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for her to have again banked on all women supporting her just because they all have vaginas is, like, not a plan.
It's not a plan. Well, and it also, one thing that I think her campaign doesn't think about is the degree to which, if you are really thoughtful about women's issues, you understand the intersectionality between these issues and a slew of other issues that are based on that are based on economic inequalities and are based on other kinds of racial inequalities, other kinds of inequalities that feed into this problem. Right. You can't just be about women.
Yeah.
If you're just about women, you're only about white women.
Yeah. Like, I know.
You know, if you don't think about these other issues,
and
I understand that, you know, I know that the black community, for example, is not really familiar with Bernie Sanders.
Right.
So to some, he's not polling well. And he said in this debate, when South Carolina voters become familiar with who I am, they will see that my record speaks for
and
itself.
I think he's right.
And I think he's right. And I think also, you know, he is the candidate who, when he got Black Lives Mattered, he immediately went about creating a plan so that they would feel included in his campaign.
Right.
That is,
and he got a huge endorsement.
And he got a huge endorsement
from
them
this week.
From Sean
White.
Exactly.
So, I mean,
so he is a candidate who offers a perspective on sort of intersectional isms.
Yes.
And
right.
And that is the most feminist candidate when you think about it.
Yeah.
And also, it's sort of just insulting to women that that this would be, like, I wouldn't vote for Margaret Thatcher.
No.
I didn't vote for Sarah Palin.
No, you didn't.
I wasn't
going to
vote for Michelle Bachmann. I mean, there's been a slew of women who've been running at this stage that I would never have supported.
Right.
Like, I mean, I wouldn't have supported Margaret Thatcher for obvious reasons at any point, because I couldn't have. But you know, I mean, this is not an inevitable choice for women to make, and she has almost been dismissive, and through her sort of shill, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, has recently been very dismissive of younger women, in terms of how they interact with the sort of current political climate.
It's
just annoying.
The richest thing from this entire article just makes me so happy, I can't even, like, begin to tell you, is that all of these Clinton people who were interviewed said that the campaign now wished that they would have pressed for more debates. Because, as we know, both Sanders and O'Malley wanted more debates because everybody, the conventional wisdom was that, you know, the less debates that you have, you know, helps the front runner because, you know, it always helps, you know, the people who are not winning, the underdogs, if you will, to be on the stage and have
to
sort of like
exposure.
To get the exposure and to be standing right next to the person who, you know, thinks that she should be president.
Right.
And what has ended up happening is that she's actually a very good debater. And many people would probably tell you that she is a better debater than Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley. And what has happened is that since all of these debates have been on, you know, Saturday nights or Sunday nights when football games are on 3-day weekends or what have you, no one sees her debate. And what that leaves you with is, who is the most inspirational person on the stump?
And it's not her.
And when it comes down to that, then she gets smoked.
Yeah.
So
it's
like,
speaker.
You know, she and Debbie Wasserman Schultz hatched this plan to not have any debates. And in hindsight, she should have been trying to have a debate every damn day.
Yeah. No, this is her wheelhouse. This is what, when you're sort of a polished professional, as she is in this sort of world, this is what gives you the kind of presidential look. Every time that she's been on national television on some sort of stand, whether it was during those Benghazi hearings, whether it is on these debate stages.
Yeah, that's where she
kills. She looks presidential.
Yeah.
She could have looked presidential every fucking week if she had wanted to.
Yeah.
And instead, she looks like a desperate lunatic for most of time and then gets only 6 opportunities on weekends to look presidential.
Exactly. I
know. In any case. Also, I want to talk for a moment about their sort of disdain for millennial voters and the fact that they are not, that her campaign is not tracking well with millennial voters.
Yeah.
Because I want to sort of remind everyone that millennial...
She got a question about this.
She got
at
a question
the debate,
about
this, by the way,
she didn't answer. She didn't answer.
By the way,
and
sorry,
certainly,
I didn't mean to interrupt
no,
you,
but I mean, she, not only that, but she had sort of like a sort of smirky remark to the YouTuber.
Congratulations on your 5 million followers.
Yeah. She said it like
thanks.
Yeah, exactly. But millennials are products of the Clinton generation.
Right.
We our entire political worldview has been formed by the Clintons.
My most vivid memories growing up in terms of politics all stemmed from both
Clintons.
Of those elections, stemmed from you know, whatever was going on at the time stemmed
Millennials do not have memories of the original George Bush. We have memories of the post 9/11 era, and everything that we remember about early Democratic politics, our most formative memories of politics, especially if we grew up in political households, are of the Clinton style of Democratic
politics. So if you can't get us,
if you don't understand us, and you can't get us, and you created us, then
how
what
is that
are
possible?
You up to?
How is that? Like,
what are you doing?
Right. You made us.
I think this is something. It's like when you talk when people say that young people are so lazy, and you're like, no, well, there's no jobs, so like we're not lazy, but like it's your fault.
Just get a job.
It's your fault we don't have jobs, so figure that out. This is sort of like the same thing where they're like, young people aren't doing what they're supposed to do. You created us.
Yeah.
So if we're not doing what you want us to do, that's on you because you created us.
Yeah.
We exist as a political entity at your behest. So you formed a generation that didn't want to vote for you.
I don't.
That's on you.
That's right. That's on
that's
you.
Not
that's
on
not
on us.
Our fault. No.
We grew up in the world we grew up in, and you are the people that made us not want to repeat that world. So fine. You created a generation of progressives, and that's your fault. In any case, her campaign was also up to other shenanigans this week, because there's this PAC, Correct the Record.
Yeah, we're going to talk about PACs coordinating with campaigns.
A few times this week.
A few times. Yeah. And this is one of them, while there's not necessarily any proof that these...
There's like literally no way that this could be... not
happened without her knowledge.
Yeah. David Brock, who is part of the Correct the Record PAC that works with the Clinton, that works for the Clinton campaign and possibly with the Clinton campaign, is expected to soon release like a sort of very public request for Sanders' health records, which is a sort of, it's the birth certificate of the old person campaign.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's coded ageism.
You're old.
It's coded ageism, is what it is.
You know who else is old? Hillary Clinton.
They're all
fucking old.
They're like 4 years apart, by the way.
Get over yourselves, people. In any case, so Twitter lost their shit.
Yeah. And John Podesta, who is Clinton's campaign manager, had to tweet at David Brock.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure he didn't want to do because he was probably the one who told David Brock to tweet
this
in the first place. He had to tweet him and he said, he said, at David Brock DC, chill out. We're fighting on who would make a better president, not who has a better physical fitness test. So they had to disown this and walk it back.
Yeah.
Now I'm sure they would tell you that they had no knowledge of David Brock.
Well, that's
what
they have to legally tell you because it's illegal for them to
But obviously, probably John Podesta himself had emailed David Brock and said, hey, ask for Bernie Sanders' health records.
Exactly. The Sanders campaign, by the way, was like, well, we were going to release these
anyway.
So, oh well.
So it's a non-issue, but it's a shady non-issue.
This is a classic Sanders response, by the way, to being like, well, fine, we were going to do this anyway.
No.
You want a response on this thing? Fine.
Yeah.
We don't agree. That's our response. You know, they're good at sort of smoothing over those kinds of crazy political, you know, hysteria moments.
Yeah.
So that's what they did here.
Yeah. Now,
meanwhile, the reason that all of this hysteria is going on, and we've talked about this sort of, is that Clinton's lead in Iowa is rapidly diminishing. We talked about this last week, and, you know, this was part of the issue with her healthcare hysteria this week.
Now,
but we want to give you some numbers.
Right, and I think that, you know, the number is 42-40, Clinton leading, with O'Malley at, what
4%.
Is it, 4%. But those numbers are not the numbers that I think probably concern her. It's not the overall poll numbers, because there are a lot of, when you dig into these numbers, that's where it becomes, I think, highly troubling for her. And I am here to make a bold declaration this week. I think Bernie Sanders is going to win Iowa. And I think that there is potential for it to not be close.
Ooh, I'm excited.
I'm not going to declare that yet.
Right.
But I think there are some seriously good numbers for him in this in this poll, which is the Des Moines Register poll, which is notably the most trusted poll. Everybody always waits on the edge of their seat for the Des Moines Register poll to come out with these caucuses. And there are a few things that make me feel like I can say that.
This.
One of them is that the number who now say that they are either undecided or who plan to stand up for uncommitted at the caucus is 14%, which is up from 8% a month ago.
Now, people are in the process of changing their mind.
And the reason that this has gotten closer is not because Sanders has gone up. It's because Hillary Clinton has gone down, which what that means is that all of the, basically, you know, the new 6% of people who are now saying that they are undecided or uncommitted are people who have left the Clinton campaign. And what the common knowledge would be there is the reason that they are doing that is because they felt like they were voting for the person who was going to win, or they felt was going to win the general election, or they felt
was the most responsible, reasonable candidate.
They are now rethinking those things. Yeah. And that's not to say that all 14% of people who are saying that are going to go for Sanders. I don't think that you can declare that, but you have to assume that a certain chunk of them are, and you have to believe that the reason that they are saying that they are no longer in Hillary's corner is because they are giving other candidates a serious look now.
Well, and it's because, I mean, this has been sort of the story from the get-go with Hillary's numbers, but it's sort of all coming down to this week,
right,
where everyone sort of had a sense of who she was 20 years ago. So there was not really time for anyone, or there was not really a need for anyone to reconsider Hillary.
Yeah.
You were already considering her when she right. declared her candidacy.
Yeah, exactly.
What you hadn't been considering is who Bernie Sanders was
right.
because you didn't know who he was because right. you live in Iowa and he's a socialist from Vermont.
Right.
So at this yes. point, at the point that these candidates all declared, there was a gap just in terms of who had information. But there's also been a gap in terms of who seemed like a likely winner. And
right.
that changed when those polls came out last week that started to show that he polls better against a lot of the Republicans and that
right.
he was this close to her.
Right.
So suddenly you're seeing people who are like, well, wait a minute. She's not the inevitable winner.
Yeah.
I was voting for her because she was going to win. Now yeah. what?
There are other very troublesome numbers, which I think is probably why Hillary Clinton was freaking the fuck
yes.
out this week. Because, like I said, it wasn't just that 42 to 40 number. When you look at the, you know, the sort of coalition that Obama was able to put together in Iowa, not necessarily nationally, but in Iowa to win that caucus in 2008, they were with political independents, they were with people under 45, and they were with people who were going to the caucus for the first time. And Sanders, in some cases, by a 2-to-1 margin,
yeah.
is in by a 3-to-1 margin with political independents. I mean, he's really
he's killing
blowing
it with all those
her
groups.
Out of the water in like a very, very epic way.
Yeah.
And so that has to seriously trouble her. It's 62 to 21 with independents who say that they're going to the Democratic caucus. It's 59 to 27 with people under 45. And 45 is, you know, that's not like, you know, a 25-year-old.
No,
that's like
45-year-olds are Reagan generation
is a lot
people.
Of people. Yeah, exactly.
It's the Reagan generation
right,
people.
Exactly.
Those people are horrible.
Yeah, and right. Bingo. And 52 to 34 with first-time caucus goers, really the only groups that she leads with are, you know, oldsters.
Right.
And registered, like, you know, generic registered Democrats.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are a lot of people who are going to vote in the Iowa caucus who are registered Democrats.
46-year-old registered
and that's
Democrats.
Where that's where she's making up, you know, by losing so terribly
yeah.
with independents. But, you know, there's another, also 57% of the people in this poll said that the issues were what was most important, as opposed to 30% who said leadership, you know, you can read that as experience or
right.
what. So that's almost a 2-to-1 margin there.
In
and
favor of the thing that is Bernie's wheelhouse.
Exactly. Because if you're voting for if you're voting for Bernie, you're voting for
on
him
the
because
issues.
Of the, you're voting
right.
on the issues.
You're not voting for him because
right.
of his leadership skills.
Right. So that 57 to 30% are more focused on the issues
yeah.
has to, again, be a troubling sign for
yeah.
her. So
well,
I think
and especially
that,
because she devoted a lot of breath early in her campaign into talking about how she was the most qualified. And the
right.
you know, that was sort of one of their earlier tracks. She's never been great on the issues. She knows that. So
right.
she changes her mind on them a lot.
Yeah.
So she's always been sort of trying to push this narrative that she has the most leadership experience, that she is the person who sort of understands what it is to be commander-in-chief and
right.
all, you know, all of these things that
worked out
that
really
her,
great in 2008, didn't
it? Yes. That her White House experience and her Senate experience and her Secretary of State experience were all supposedly leading us towards.
Right.
And what we're finding is that no one gives a shit
right.
about any of those
because she
things.
Has crappy ideas.
She has bad ideas. And as we've said before, if you have experience, but your experience has led you to wrong conclusions, that doesn't, you're not a better candidate than
no.
someone with less experience and right conclusions. We
big
wrote
deal.
A whole post about this on our blog.
We sure did.
Good ideas are not the same thing. I mean, good leadership experience is not the same thing as good ideas.
It's not.
Two different things.
Yeah.
In any case, every time she attacks him, she does that at her own peril anyway. Because one of the things that the Sanders campaign in that New York Times article, the Clinton campaign in that New York Times article talked about was how they're baffled as to how Bernie is raising so much money.
Right. Well, here's one reason.
Every time that she attacks him, he makes millions of dollars overnight.
Just between Tuesday and Saturday, when this whole healthcare debacle started going down, he made $3.1 million.
Every time the
Democrats do something
like this, it's like when they...
For
that one night that he didn't have access to the voter rolls, he made over a million dollars
in 24 hours.
And
yeah.
As we've said before, these are from donors who are not capping out.
Yes.
You know, this is something that we've talked about in the past on this podcast, but Hillary Clinton has a lot of richer donors. Yeah. So a lot of her donors have capped out. They've given the maximum
amount. And once they cap out, then they just give to her super PAC.
Exactly. Bernie Sanders donors are donating like $30. So they can keep donating $30 every time she says one of these stupid things till the end of time.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to cap out donating $30 every month.
Right.
You know, like they can just keep going till November.
Yeah.
So this is also a bad sign, because when you have a million people donating $30 every time that she says something stupid, it's like she's handing him money. He's made of money.
Right.
No. Like, it's bonkers.
Yeah.
And his campaign operates with a much smaller budget than
hers. That's what I was going to say. Like, unlike Hillary, when he makes $3.1 million in a week, that is serious business for him right there.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, way more time than he gets to spend on the air in early states. That's more people that he gets to hire in these states. That's more, you know, I mean, like that's
because he's literally flying coach around the country right now.
Say,
so his campaign, his overhead's not that high.
$3.1 million in 5 days is serious money. For him. And like every time she does it, it's doing
it
that
multiplies.
For him. And it's like, so not genius.
Also, he's got some great Twitter people working for him. And I
know.
Think it's not even his campaign. I think it's just that his campaign, the people who love his campaign are young, and so they're finding stuff on Twitter
I was one of
it's
the
like
things...
It's like Anonymous is working for him.
Yeah, exactly. Because he was really trolling her on Twitter this week, and one of the things that he posted was like this tweet from John Podesta from 2013, where it was John Podesta said, just applied online for Medicare, took 5 minutes, single payer, anyone?
Remember when John Podesta and the Hillary Clinton world all loved single player?
Right, I know. Well, and I said to you, I was like, how did somebody on team find this random tweet from John Podesta from 2013?
Nobody did.
And you were like, it was probably just some
tweeted at them.
Rando person who was like, you know, some 20-year-old who is a huge Bernie fan. Probably wasn't even anybody on staff.
No. Probably people are tweeting them this shit all the time. They also sent, there was a picture of a card, it was a photograph, that was of Hillary Clinton when she was the first lady, and Bernie Sanders. And her note to him at the bottom says, "To Bernie Sanders, with thanks for your commitment to real healthcare access for all Americans and best wishes. Hillary Rodham Clinton, 1993, just before her big defeat on healthcare in 1994. They also posted a video of her in 2008. Saying that she was getting furious at Obama because he was going after her for differences between their healthcare proposals.
Right.
Because she was saying that Democrats shouldn't go after each other on healthcare.
Right. Because they're
be
all
united.
Trying to get to the
We're
same
all doing
thing.
The same
so
thing.
It's like we shouldn't, you know, attack people's, you know, minutiae differences in their plans.
My, how times have changed.
Yeah, exactly. Now, as if the first half hour of this podcast
probably
has
more.
Not been enough of an endorsement for Bernie Sanders and
That's
a takedown of
47 minutes of this
I told you this podcast was going to be 2 hours. You know what? Fine.
It's fine. We had a lot to say.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, as if you need further reason to vote for Bernie Sanders, this week, Bill O'Reilly... Sorry, I lost my train of thought there. Bill O'Reilly said that if Bernie Sanders becomes the president, he will move to Ireland, of all places.
First of all...
Don't know how we got to Ireland.
It's
but
nice, though. This gives
whatever.
Ireland... a chance to figure out how to not take it gives them enough warning to figure out how to not take Bill O'Reilly, so that's nice.
But if you're on the fence between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, like, let this be your decider right here.
Well, and he even said, I shouldn't say it publicly because that will get Sanders more votes, but I'm not going to pay 90% of my income to that guy. I'm sorry, I'm not doing it. I mean, I don't think there's a world in which you would have to, but if that is the fake threat that makes you move to Ireland... By all means, become Ireland's problem.
Exactly.
We're sick of you.
Yeah.
Here's a siren. She's coming by slowly into our sound studio, driving straight through our sound studio.
Yeah.
In any case, another sort of Sanders-Clinton kerfluffle that broke out this week was over this Iran deal that we're about to go into the details of. But Sanders, in one of his other trolling moments of Hillary Clinton, remembered, because, you know, we're going to tell you the details, but there were some prisoners that were released, American prisoners released in Iran this week. Sanders was talking about it on television, and he was asked, he said that it wouldn't have happened under Clinton, and this is why. Yeah. He said, if you think back to, I think it was 2007, during the campaign in which Secretary Clinton ran against Barack Obama, she was critical of him. A question was asked to Obama that said, would you sit down and talk to the Iranians? And he said, yeah, I would. Point being that if you talk to your adversaries, you don't run away from that. Secretary Clinton, I think, called him naive. Turns out Obama was right.
Yeah.
Basically, he remembered one of the glorious moments of the 2007 debates,
yeah,
in which Obama was called naive by Hillary Clinton for saying that he would talk to Iran.
Yeah.
Now, we're talking to Iran. We've gotten we got a nuclear deal and prisoners released.
Yeah.
Things are going well.
I know.
Our talking to them is working.
Yeah.
And Hillary Clinton, who is still sitting there saying that we shouldn't be talking to Iran, is once again proven.
I wish that he would have brought this up at the debate tonight, because I feel like
I was waiting for him to say it.
He was, because obviously talking about your opponent hating on Barack Obama was a real applause line this evening. And I feel like this could have been his one moment to invoke, you know.
Hillary Clinton got so up in the Bernie Sanders was not being supportive enough of Obama that Twitter at one point erupted in reminders that she had run against him.
I know, right.
Where we all had to be
lest we forget.
Like, this is insane, because even though you worked in his administration, in 2008, you ran a campaign against him.
Right.
You called him naive, among a lot of other things.
I was going to say, not only did you call him naive, you ran a sort of, you know, codedly racist campaign against him, like, on a lot of levels.
Exactly. Like, what on earth are you talking about?
I know. Yeah.
In any case, here's some more info on this Iranian hostage release trade thing. Basically, this week, four Americans who were imprisoned in Iran for, like, years on, like, trumped up Iran charges.
Right.
Were released in a deal with Iran. And this was, you know, this was one of the things that was one of the GOP talking points against the Iran nuclear deal, where they said that the nuclear deal was no good because we hadn't gotten these prisoners released.
Right.
And it turns out they had been working behind the scenes to get this.
They've been working on this for like 14 months.
Yeah. They had been trying to get these prisoners released in a separate deal.
Right.
And we'll talk about why they did that.
Yeah.
The prisoners were a Washington Post correspondent, Jason I can't pronounce any of their names, by the way. I don't know why I just started to try.
Yeah.
There was a former Marine. There was a pastor.
Yes, this Christian pastor, too, has been a big Christian.
Saeed Abedini.
Big GOP talking point, basically, that, like,
we don't care about Christians.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And then this mystery man with a crazy name, whose provenance and business in Iran have not been released to the public.
Yeah.
Nobody knows who he is. He was not on the plane out of Iran, so no one knows where he is. And even Bill O'Reilly was quoted as saying he had never heard of this person. I mean, not Bill O'Reilly, Wolf Blitzer.
Yeah.
It's bad that I mixed those two up. Even Wolf Blitzer was saying that he had no
idea
who this person
was. They're
not as
far apart as you would want them
to
be.
So true. So true. In any case, this name/mystery situation is something that we're going to refer to as pure applesauce, because it's such a weird side note to this story.
Yeah.
In any case, it happened after 14 months of secret negotiations. And then on top of that, on Saturday, the International Atomic Energy Agency reported that Iran had complied with the nuclear the nuclear deal from July.
The timing of it sort of coincided with that, but
so
it didn't
was just like
necessarily
a coincidental
have,
good thing that
it didn't,
happened.
It didn't have, you know, direct correlation to it,
but
necessarily.
But it did trigger it sanction relief at the time that this was all going on.
Exactly.
So that was, I think, probably a helpful thing,
yes,
if nothing else.
Yes.
And then in exchange for this exchange, the U.S. is dropping charges against a few Iranians who are being sanctioned here. So, in any case, this is all sort of like, there was a lot of Iran news this week because of that, because there was this sort of news that they were complying with a nuclear deal. And because of that, there was a lot of news about lifting sanctions, which there was a bunch of political processes that were triggered in the U.S. to lift some of these sanctions.
Right.
And then it was actually Iran who suggested doing this prisoner swap. But they sort of said that the reason that they hadn't connected it to the nuclear deal, or this is, I think, what people are kind of thinking was the case. The nuclear deal was a lot to contend with in and of itself. And this was
like,
just like an unrelated complicating factor.
Why muddy the waters with trying to do this prisoner deal as part of the nuclear deal? It was an unrelated issue.
It was an unrelated issue.
And
they were worried also that if the deal didn't work out, then these prisoners would never get
released. Right, exactly. If you couple the prisoner deal with the nuclear deal and the nuclear deal goes down, then you don't really have a leg to stand on to go back and be like, oh, hey, by the way, you know those four people that we wanted to get out of the country? Like,
exactly.
So they...
Well, and the other thing was they didn't want the appearance of capitulating to Iran during the nuclear deal. I mean, that was something that the GOP would have also filleted them for.
Right, exactly.
So they wanted to make it clear that Iran wasn't really, like, getting anything in the nuclear deal.
Right, because if you make it seem like Iran is getting something in the nuclear deal because they captured more Americans, then Iran just becomes emboldened to just keep capturing any old American and then, you know, being able to get something for it.
Right.
So, like, it made sense that they weren't doing it. Although the GOP is just too short-sighted to be able to sort of process this. They can't have multiple thoughts.
No, they're not good at that. This is diplomacy at work. This is a kind of international action that none of the GOP field and Hillary Clinton would approve of.
Right.
So the reason that these prisoners are home is because we have taken action in direct, you know, defiance of what Hillary Clinton and the GOP candidates all think.
Yeah. Exactly. And there are some, it was interesting because there are some new sanctions now, which, you know, the optics seem sort
very
of weird because
sanctions.
They're very specific because what happened was, you know, when they complied with the, this nuclear deal, they had some huge sanctions lifted by us, by the UN.
They were allowed
the
to re-enter the world's oil market.
Right.
They were able to enter and leave foreign ports.
Right.
They now have, their citizens have access to global financial markets. They have access to $100 billion in frozen funds. So they have suddenly a much broader access to just the economy in general.
Right, exactly.
So there were some specific sanctions that replaced them on specific individuals.
Individuals or entities.
Or entities,
yes, exactly.
Or
so those are not sanctions that are going to necessarily be felt by, you know, everyday Iranians or the Iranian economy.
They're people or companies that were accused of shipping technologies to Iran and, you know, missile parts and stuff like that.
Exactly.
So that it's stuff to
so
protect.
So those people are sanctioned, but we lifted the, you know, the general sanctions on the country.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So in any case, that was good news this week.
Yeah.
Unless you hate Iran, then it was bad news, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what.
Right.
What Republicans are thinking about this.
Who knows?
Who can guess?
Yeah. They were mad about it, of course.
Well, of course. But they're mad about it. It's like, they would have been mad about it regardless of what happened.
Exactly.
The outcome is irrelevant to their anger.
Yeah.
The State of the Union was this week.
It was.
We live tweeted that. So if you
missed
that, then you can scroll through our Twitter, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Sure.
Do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Some general takeaways, because in general, it was just a State of the Union speech in which it was a little bit boring, and there were
a little different.
It was a little different, and it was,
always,
it's always exciting to see what people are clapping and not clapping for. My favorite moment of the night was after not clapping for cancer research, for anything that had to do with any kind of inequality, for education, for whatever, they all got up and applauded cutting red tape.
Oh, yes.
I don't know. What inspired them to all love cutting red tape more than they loved common sense policy proposals?
Yeah.
But it was like the weirdest moment of the night because they had literally sat through everything that would have potentially been involved in cutting red tape. And then red tape was mentioned and they were like, yes!
Yeah!
Like, it was so weird.
Yeah.
In any case, it was a less policy proposal heavy speech.
Right, because what always happens at the State of the Union is, like, the president, like, lists 1,000 different specific policy proposals. None of them go anywhere. And then you've just wasted your time listening to policy proposals that are just, you know, great ideas, but, like, you know, dead on arrival. And
exactly.
So he sort of chose to not go that route, and he sort of focused on four main things.
Yeah.
And then he did sort of get a little granular with each thing, but it was the economy, technology, foreign policy, and then the fourth thing was a little vague, but it was basically sort of like making our politics reflect what's best in us.
It was
not
stopping the hateful talk,
right?
Basically,
exactly. And I think in a moment of realness, said that was one of his biggest regrets of his presidency, was the amount of gridlock and sort of, you know, clashing of the two parties, and, you know,
that has
so
sort of,
I thought that was
bloomed
kind of
in his time.
Interesting. I don't think that it'll, you know, I don't think it's going to make anybody come together any quicker,
but
I mean, but
he made some specific references to some of the rhetoric we're hearing coming out of the right. You know, he said our answer needs to be more than tough talk or calls to carpet bomb civilians. That was in response to Cruz using the term carpet bomb to talk about what we should do in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And then on Trump, or sort of referencing Trump, he said, when politicians insult Muslims, that doesn't make us safer. That's not telling it like it is. It's just wrong. It diminishes us in the eyes of the world.
Well, I think a lot of times when outgoing presidents are asked about what's going on in the current race for president, they often say things like, you know, oh, I'm staying out of it, or, oh, you know, my term is done. I'm not, you know, I'm not concerned about what's going on. But, like, he seemed very dialed into what's going on in 2016. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he obviously wants a Democrat, you know, to to succeed.
But there's a kind of rancor that also deserves response from the president because it's really poisoning the way that we speak about people and things. Yeah.
Well, and threatening our national security.
And threatening our national security on some level. Exactly. Yeah. No. He also, he talked a little bit about climate change. He talked about some other challenges in the future, like curing cancer. He put Joe Biden in charge of that.
Yep.
Joe Biden gave him the coolest gun finger slash wink. Joe Biden is so cool.
Isn't he?
And it's like, how did he stay so cool so long?
No.
It's, he,
he's like the best vice president that America has ever had.
He should stay vice president forever.
Yeah.
He's just so much cooler than all the other vice presidents.
Yeah, and that's really all you need.
That's right. He's not up to much. No. He's just doing finger winks and flashing smiles and
wearing
other
his aviators around.
Yeah.
Giving people inappropriate massages, like when they're getting sworn in. I mean, that's what you're looking for.
That's what he's up to. That's what a vice president is up to. That's, it's, he's, I know, he's the coolest. I don't know how he gets away with being so cool.
I don't either.
In any case, he talked a lot about, when he talked about national security, about making sure that we don't sort of like become victims of our own fear.
Well, I
that
really,
was,
I
think, important.
That was a very fascinating section of the speech, I think, actually, just because, like, he really sort of, I think he gave Republicans some fodder in that portion of the speech, but he didn't sort of really seem to care, because he was basically just like, ISIS is not a threat to, I mean, they're a threat to us in the way that they are a threat, but, like, he was trying to make it clear that, like, we are not threatened as the United States of America,
our national
by
security,
ISIS. Like,
our national
existence, we might have some. You know, it's obviously quite upsetting to have the types of things that happened, as did in San Bernardino.
Of course,
but like, you know, as just a country, we are not ISIS. ISIS doesn't threaten our existence as a nation.
Right.
And I think that that's important to consider, especially when you're watching Republican debates where it sounds like,
like they're on our doorstep.
Like the entire
planet is about to be. Because they've literally said that they're on our doorstep.
Right. So
those words have been used to describe the situation.
So while I thought that was sort of bold of him to say, because I think that that's that's going to be used in probably commercials in 2016, probably, like, as to his naivety of, you know, the threat.
But I think
but,
it
like,
also,
he's absolutely right, though,
right,
too.
And it's also, it's something where I think above it being a political concern, he had to say something to be like, guys, calm the fuck
down. Yeah, exactly.
Don't let fear dictate you, like,
this,
because part of this conversation about Muslims in the country, part of this conversation about, you know, about, like, or this sort of implied conversation about, you know, how we're going to treat our minority citizens of any sort,
right.
is based in this kind of, like, rootless fear that has been taken. And when we start to sort of internalize a fear of ISIS that isn't a rational fear for us to have, it is fearful from a sort of global security perspective, but it is not like you are going to be prevented from going to the grocery store by ISIS.
Right.
Like, your everyday life is not going to be impacted by ISIS in the way that it is a threat if you are an everyday citizen in Syria.
Right,
like,
exactly.
We need to remember that we still...
Or like it was as a threat during, you know, World War II.
Exactly. Right. I mean, we need to sort of remember that we don't need to come at this issue from a place of blind fear.
Right.
Like, we can come at it from a place of what is the best course forward that makes sense.
Right.
So I think it was sort of like, I think that maybe it was important for him to remind us of that, even though it's sort of a sticking point, because so much of this presidential race is being defined by blind fear.
Yeah.
Especially on the right.
Yeah.
Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
A couple other quick things, just before we get off the State of the Union.
Yeah. Were you wondering who is in the pro-cancer caucus? I've been wondering. Who's pro-cancer out there? It's hard to know.
Yeah, it's Paul Ryan.
It's Paul Ryan.
Yeah.
He's a man who heard a line about how we should cure cancer and thought to himself, not clap for that.
Nope.
I just sit here quietly
just
with
smirk
my
back here.
Smirk about how I don't care about cancer.
That's right.
Cancer, by the way, is something that cuts across party lines.
That's right.
Even Republicans get cancer.
Yeah. Kim Davis was there, and if you're wondering whether she's gotten less frumpy since she's found her newfound fame,
she hasn't. Nope. Looking as frumpy as ever,
like
wearing what someone on Twitter referred to as an AIDS quilt.
it was like,
something about, it was this hilarious tweet that was like, what do you do when, you know, you hate gays, but the AIDS quilt just looks too good on you?
That person should be commended.
That person got a lot of retweets.
I bet they did.
They were commended by the people of Twitter.
Yeah.
Also, they kept showing shots on C-SPAN of all the children in the chamber asleep.
Well. It was boring. I don't know how you stayed awake for the whole damn thing.
It was only because I was in public.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm surprised that I did stay awake for the whole thing.
Yeah.
But
did you do that from work?
Yeah, I did it from work. That's why I was awake. That's what I literally told. At one point, my boss asked me to come into his office, and I was like, well, there's 5 minutes left. I'm sorry. I have to sit here. Like, I told him no so that I could finish watching the State of the Union.
Well, good for you.
Also, one brief talk about the beginning of the State of the Union. My favorite part of the State of the Union, because I hate political speeches, is before the speech starts. I love watching everyone walk in. So I love to watch who the handshakers are.
Our arch nemesis was there.
First of all, the New York caucus are some of the best line standers in front of her.
Well, they're used to...
They can work a crowd.
Weaving
Carolyn Maloney
in and out of-
has never once failed to be at the very front of the handshake line.
Yeah.
She does not fuck around. She is there in her very brightly colored skirt suit of some sort.
Yeah.
She's, by the way, older. She's old. She's old. She's kind of teetery. She wears heels a lot. I don't know why, because she doesn't look stable on them. And she somehow manages to elbow her way into the front of that crowd every single year. You know who else was at the front of the line? A person who didn't deserve to be at the front of the line at all. No. Our arch nemesis, Julia Brownlee, was there being tall and standing in front of short people, blocking their access to the handshake line.
Yeah, she probably shoved them out of the way.
I bet she did.
She probably threatened them with putting them on her email list.
One person who doesn't deserve
get out of my way or I'll email you 17 times a day and I mean it.
And that's a serious threat, guys. So if that's what she said to you, I respect that you stood back.
Right. Get out of there. Get out of her way.
But one person who didn't need any screen time or a shot of her shaking the president's hand is Julia fucking Brownlee.
No.
For reasons that we've explained on our blog, go check it out. In any case, Nikki Haley delivered the State of the Union response.
Yep.
She was super dull.
She was dull, but she did something very curious and interesting. Yes.
She did something very bold. She said, and I quote, "During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation." And for saying that, she got a huge lash, huge outcry. I don't know. What word was I going to use?
A huge outcry.
She generated a huge outcry from the right on Twitter.
Yeah.
Because she basically took a coded swipe at Donald Trump.
Ann Coulter said that Donald Trump should deport her.
Yes, right?
Yes.
Nothing like classy Ann Coulter.
This was obviously directed at Donald Trump, which she even said the next morning because she was asked about it. And she was like, well, yeah, I was talking about Donald Trump.
What else would I be talking about?
Come on.
Yeah. Laura Ingraham went after her on Twitter, saying that she missed an opportunity to, quote, stand with working people who want borders enforced, and that her speech was, quote, an echo of George W. Bush, Jeb, Lindsey Graham-style republicanism.
Yeah.
I love that that's become an insult in the conservative community.
I know, right? In related news, Lindsey Graham endorsed Jeb Bush. I don't know what either of them get from that, by the way. Like, what does that do for anyone?
Calls in the wind.
Exactly. Yes. If Lindsey Graham makes an endorsement in the forest.
Right. And nobody listens. Did it happen? Right,
exactly. Yes. But I, you know, the Nikki Haley thing was like very interesting to me because I think that, you know, she has sort of like found her moment in the sun recently with this whole, you know, Confederate flag thing in South Carolina. But I think it's important to remember where Nikki Haley came from.
Let's talk about the provenance of Nikki Haley.
Right. Because she is a woman who ran under the Tea Party mantle against the, you know, the country club establishment in South Carolina. She was elected in large part because she got Sarah Palin to come down there and campaign for her. And it's so fascinating to me that she is now sort of tacking to, I guess one could say the center-ish kind of, but like, you know, so many people are talking about, you know, her as a vice presidential candidate, which as we mentioned last week was started by Carla Nordstrom.
Right.
God bless her.
Right.
And she
a correct
is,
things said
right,
by Carla
exactly
Murphy.
And I just don't know what her I mean I guess on some level I appreciate that she said this because she's absolutely right.
Well,
but like
I
don't know what if her plan is to be vice president. I don't know whose vice president she's attempting to be
right now
because it's not going to be Donald Trump's clearly any longer. And it's probably, I feel like, maybe with a statement like this, not going to be Ted Cruz. Granted, Ted Cruz hasn't gone so far in the, you know, insanity realm as Donald Trump has on these issues. But, like, if she is sort of, like,
going more to the center
and saying things like this, like, this is not the type of thing that she can go out and say as Ted Cruz's vice presidential candidate and have the people who are supporting Ted Cruz
feel okay
with. Yeah. So I think it's, while maybe on some level admirable for her, I don't know what it gets her politically,
she
I guess.
She can be Jeb's VP in their
but that's not a thing.
Student council election.
I was
going
to say, Jeb doesn't get to have a VP
no.
because Jeb is not a person who's going to be the nominee for president.
Yeah. It's all an exercise.
So I found that very interesting. Just politically.
I wonder if it was not really her decision, but if the party was like, we need to keep the center.
I think you're probably right.
Like, we need to make sure that there is a reasonable voice.
Well, it's obviously an establishment person who asks her to do that. So, exactly. You know, and
what does she care about principles?
Yeah.
She doesn't have them.
No, she doesn't. You're right. Good point. I hadn't thought of that. When you put it that way.
Sure, I'll attack Donald Trump.
I'll say whatever you want me to say.
Am I on national television? Great. Speaking of, the GOP debate was the millionth GOP debate that happened on Thursday. It was basically like all Trump and Cruz.
Yeah.
There were still 1 trillion people on stage, but none of them were interesting to anyone.
Yeah.
And
we should mention, too, it is worth going back and digging into our Twitter feed to go read those tweets because,
bless
his soul, Grant Sloss, friend of the podcast, live tweeted for us because neither of us were in front of the TV and did... like the people's work.
He did a heroic job of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
he said, what do you want me to tweet? And I was like, something funnier than I would say. And he took it to heart.
He went and did that.
He might have gone too far. He might have gone further than I wanted him to. Because
he's making us look less funny by the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but we are so grateful that he did that because being part of the conversation for these debates is really our joy. Like, it's like the greatest part of this
and
cycle.
We got to be on Twitter live tweeting it without actually having to watch it, which I think we should start doing more of. Because
it's a great.
Who wants to watch that?
No.
Nobody.
I was able to wake up the next morning having appeared to have watched a debate that I did not have to watch.
I know.
The big moments, though, were all Trump Cruz moments, and it is partially because we are finally going full birther on Cruz.
Yeah!
We've been waiting for this moment for a long time. We were personally trolling him for a long time just because no one was doing it.
Yeah, we're going to take credit for this.
We're going to take credit for this, absolutely. Trump is finally coming out of the woodwork, but he's doing it in a really interesting way because he's doing it as if he's just worried about other people doing it.
Oh, he doesn't want the Democrats to do it.
It's the Democrats might sue him, and I worry what will happen if that happens. I, of course, have no questions.
No.
But I'm asking this because Democrats have questions.
Right.
I'm speaking for the potential Democrats who are potentially worried about this birther movement that I started.
Yes.
So, Cruz did a good job of rebutting it because he said that Trump back in September had said that it wasn't going to be an issue for Cruz and then said that the Constitution hasn't changed since September.
Yes.
But it's sort of, I think, in a weird moment of honesty, Trump sort of acknowledged that the reason he was now going after Cruz was because of the polls. Because what does Trump have to hide?
Right. Well, if you're going to love Trump for anything, it's got to be for, you know,
saying
whatever comes into his brain.
It's not always good stuff.
It's not always good stuff. It's a lot of times not.
It's not usually good stuff.
Sometimes it's terrifying stuff.
Right.
But like, you know, the fact that he said that, I think you would not find another candidate anywhere
who would acknowledge
that he was upping his attacks based solely on the fact that polls were tightening.
It's sort of interesting performance art because he's sort of deconstructing what it is to run a campaign in front of our eyes because he's admitting to his every move as he does it.
Yeah.
It's like I once read a critique. I'm very into thinking about things as performance art right now. I read a critique once of Britney Spears' meltdown as performance art versus as just like a crazy thing that happened.
Yeah.
And it was sort of brilliant performance art because she sort of deconstructed what it is to be a media starlet in front of our eyes and threw it back in our faces.
Yeah. As much as I love her, I would probably contend that she's not that smart. But
I don't think,
anyway.
But it wasn't, she was living the performance art.
No,
she wasn't consciously doing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But she cut her hair in front of our eyes and then attacked a paparazzi
with
an
umbrella. Yeah.
Like, that was performance art because it sort of deconstructed what it is to be stuck in that machine, and she threw all of the symbols of her fame back in our face.
Yeah.
The photographers that made her famous, the hair that was the flowing blonde locks that made her famous, all of that she stripped in front of our eyes.
Yeah.
That is, I feel like, what happens a lot with Donald Trump, where he sort of deconstructs what it is to be in a presidential campaign
that's
in front of our eyes.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like performance art.
Yeah.
Because he's sort of explaining the logic of what's happening in really like dumbed down terms so you can totally understand what they are. Like
certainly members of his party can understand.
And I think in this cycle in particular, people are responding to that.
Yeah.
Because this is a cycle where people are sick of politics as usual, and he is not he is explaining how he's not participating in politics as usual as he does it.
Yeah.
So it's sort of interesting.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. And he's terrible.
Right.
But it's interesting.
Yeah.
The other big moment of a showdown between the two of them came because Ted Cruz has been ragging on what he calls New York values.
Yes. Well, this
Ted
is
Ted Cruz. Go fuck yourself.
Well, also,
I will
yeah,
not hear of this insult to New Yorkers.
Exactly. Well, and also, you know, he's been talking about this for a while, actually, and for the last week, Donald Trump has been addressing it, and he has used this 9/11 story before in campaign speeches. So I don't know why Ted Cruz brought it up, because it seemed as though he walked right into this. Because
he
this
walked
was,
right into allowing someone else to say 9/11.
And this
That's
was
never a smart
right,
move.
And not just to say 9/11, but like actually probably the most close that Trump has ever like stepped into seeing presidential, seeming
yeah.
presidential. Like, it was actually a moment where you were like, oh, I could maybe vote for you, not me specifically,
right.
but just sort of like a general
right.
idiot person, you know, who
yeah.
isn't already supporting him because he's a racist.
Right.
Like, could have
Imagine
a moment
that
where
you're part of the I'm not specifically racist but don't care about racism
right.
caucus.
Like, he allowed Trump to give an answer
that made him look presidential.
Right.
Yeah.
And he did, because, you know, the moderators asked Cruz himself what New York values were, because he sort of hadn't really ever explained what those were, and he didn't really do a good job of explaining what they were. He was like, well, people of South Carolina know what they are, and then everyone laughed in the room, but then really didn't go into detail.
Right.
And Donald Trump was like, slow your roll.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about how we rebuilt after 9/11
yeah.
to huge applause in the room.
Well,
and like, and even Ted Cruz in the split screen
what?
Was applauding.
What?
Applauding.
Oh no.
Because he had to, you can't be a Republican not applauding something about 9/11,
no.
for God's sake.
I feel like it is always a foolish move to allow someone else to say 9/11.
Yes.
Don't be the guy who
yeah.
invites a 9/11 reference from
right.
somebody else. Be the guy that said 9/11.
Right.
In a GOP
right.
debate, that's my advice to GOP debaters near and far.
Yeah. Only Hillary Clinton has messed up a 9/11 answer, by the way.
Only,
Further proof that she's a shit candidate. Back to my rage.
How hard is it to fucking get
right?
a 9/11 answer, right?
I know, right?
Say America, rebuild,
right.
winning, whatever right. you need to say. There's
I'm for big banks because 9/11,
like,
lest we forget.
Right.
You know, a couple
we,
debates ago.
Right.
That,
way, was, one of, that was one of her worst debate
Ryan's.
Moments, by
yeah,
the way. Maybe
exactly.
that was why they had initially jumped on the no debates train.
Right, exactly.
So you say shit like that.
Yeah.
But it's never the right move in any kind of political
to
realm.
To walk into a 9/11
to,
answer.
To give someone else a 9/11 answer.
Exactly.
Don't hand those out.
No.
Keep them for yourself.
Yeah.
In any case, Christine Cruz also went at it. That's irrelevant because no one cares about Chris Christie.
Right.
But they hate each other. And that's because they're both evil people who are not
right.
nice.
Well, they're both competing for the establishment ticket out of New Hampshire.
Yeah.
That's
why Christie's they're polling fairly well in New Hampshire,
yes.
all things considered.
Yeah.
He... Like,
and by fairly well, we mean he's in third place with 10%.
Correct. Right. He's pulling fairly well in that he is the leader of the establishment pack, so he's in third place
right.
overall.
Yeah.
And Kasich, meanwhile, got the most engagement from an 89-year-old former Democratic rep, John Dingell.
And not the type of engagement you would want,
no.
by the way. But
he was mostly remembered, or he was mostly noticed because of a tweet that John Dingell sent out, which was, John Kasich tells more back in my day rocking chair stories than me or anyone I know, and I was born during the Coolidge administration.
So good.
Also, hilariously, Rand Paul was knocked down to the kiddie table and just didn't go.
Yeah.
So he was like, fuck you guys.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
fine.
Well,
I mean, once you're at the kiddie table, who cares?
I was
going to
say, as
Don't
I said,
you.
I was like, if you're faced with the option of debating Carly Fiorina, Mike Huckabee, and Rick Santorum,
or nobody.
Or staying home, then,
right.
like, the choice is clear
it's a
at
clear
that
choice.
Point.
It's an easy choice. He has a glimmer of rationality every once in a while, and this is one of the moments that I think he chose right.
He did the right thing.
He did the yeah. right thing, exactly. Yeah. Meanwhile, Hugh Hewitt was on a CNN panel talking about the debate and admitted what I think we've all known this whole time, which is that facts don't matter.
No.
They were talking about... Rubio had been hitting Chris Christie on his flip-flop about whether he would support Sotomayor for the Supreme Court nomination. And they were talking about various fact-checking matters, mm-hmm. having to do with that, and a couple of other things that Rubio was hitting Cruz for and stuff like that. Hewitt was interjecting himself into the middle of the conversation to say, fact-checking doesn't matter in these things. What matters is personality and aura, and your command presence and all of those, too. The best command presence last night was Donald Trump and Marco Rubio.
There you go.
Fact-checking doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Don't worry about facts, guys.
Nope.
I mean, if there's anything that
and
we
they
know...
they haven't been.
Right. We know that fact-checking doesn't matter to them. He also went on to say, what matters is who can beat Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that maybe that might not matter so much.
I was gonna, it might not matter.
That might not
it
be...
Might,
that
the
might
answer
be
to that question might also be all of them.
Exactly.
So... Which is unfortunate.
It's an unfortunate reality that we live in. Meanwhile, Trump and Cruz are now really going at each other's
Throat. Well, even as recently as this debate, which was like on
Thursday.
I mean, so it's been but 4 days. Like, he was even saying things like, he's been all along saying, like, I like Ted Cruz.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. Ted Cruz and I agree on a lot of things. You know, they are both sort of like from the same realm of, you know, Donald Trump is angrier, obviously, but they both, you know, are working with the same pool of voters and ideas.
Up until this point, Donald Trump has been saying that he likes Ted Cruz. Right. That's the important thing for you to remember for context.
Now he
story.
Hates the side of his face.
He now doesn't like Ted Cruz. It started because, and it's still about this New York values comment. This was not after being the big sticking point in the GOP debate. Cruz went on to apologize for it by not apologizing and insulting everyone further. Because he said, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Andrew Cuomo, and Bill de Blasio have all demanded an apology, and I'm happy to apologize. I apologize to the millions of New Yorkers who've been let down by the liberal politicians in that state. So Ted Cruz said another fuck you to New Yorkers. And Trump was asked about it on This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
Yeah.
And said in response a very Trumpian thing.
So good, yep.
The truth is, and this is of Ted Cruz, the truth is he's a nasty guy. Nobody likes him. Nobody in Congress likes him. He's very, he's got an edge that's not good. You can't make deals with people like that. It's not a good thing for the country. Very nasty guy. Then he went on to say that Trump was a total hypocrite because he'd been hosting fundraisers in New York and had not, and we're going to talk about this in a second, it was just announced that he didn't disclose a bunch of campaign loans from his Senate campaign from New York banks. So then he said, I'm leading Ted Cruz by a lot. The polls are showing that I'm on the upswing. He's on a big downswing. But if you look at what he said and the way he said it and that scorn towards New York, I think it's a disgrace. He's putting down the great people of New York. Who could have done what New Yorkers did after the unbelievable circumstances after 9/11?
There he goes again.
There he goes again. Neatly tied in banks, 9/11, and compliments to himself. I was gonna say, Holy Trinity.
He's going to turn into noun verb 9/11.
Yeah.
This election cycle's Rudy Giuliani.
He's the only other candidate who you can read in a New York accent, so why not?
That's true, yeah.
I feel like it's, for some reason, it's actually much easier for me to read his quotes than other candidates, because even though they're written in gibberish, you can just sort of like, you can just sort of put on a New York accent and go for it.
You specifically can hear him saying these
exactly.
things.
Exactly, right. Yeah. No, that's, I also, as a side note, and I can't remember what word it was, but Bernie Sanders says the phantom R at the end of words that don't end in R.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like I never thought I would hear that in a presidential debate. It's like how I can't even really do it because I don't have the right accent for it. But like my mother's name is Carla and people with New York accents call her Carla. Right. They have to say nasally. But they add an R to the end of her name and Bernie Sanders does that. And I was so proud to see someone on the presidential stage adding the phantom R to the end of words.
Well, you said to me earlier this week, like, besides the fact that you just, for entertainment purposes and because you love Bernie Sanders, hope that it's Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, just because it would be two people from Manhattan. Or not Manhattan, he's from Brooklyn,
he's
but
from
two
Brooklyn,
people from New York City.
And Donald Trump is from Queens.
Exactly.
I will not take credit for Donald Trump.
Manhattan.
But two New Yorkers battling it out. What an exciting time to be alive, guys. I never thought, as a New Yorker who grew up in the era where New York was like persona non grata to every political situation, that I would see two New Yorkers legitimately polling really high in a presidential campaign.
Yeah.
I feel proud of that, even though one of them is a complete idiot.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm excited.
Yeah. Ted Cruz, some shady campaign finance
the story
past. Shocker.
That Trump was referring to.
Yeah.
So campaigns are required by the FEC to disclose the sources of their funding. And that is either, you know, that can be personal money or it can be loans from financial institutions. The genesis of the Cruz monster is his 2012 campaign for Senate. And in that campaign, the lore goes that the Cruzes put $1 million of their own money and all of their savings, you know, they put all of their savings to launch his Tea Party upstart campaign.
Right.
And in the weeks right before the primary, he put $960,000 into a Senate campaign.
Of his own money.
Of his own money. 2 months later, before the scheduled runoff, he added more. It totaled $1.2 million. Give or take.
Yeah.
This was interesting since when he became a senator, he was forced to submit financial disclosures. And the disclosures that he filed with the Senate did not find, there was no liquidation of an asset that would have explained where he got this
$1.2 million. Right.
So all this money that he spent, there was no way to account for it in his financial disclosures.
Yeah.
But what it did show was that in the first half of 2012, Ted and Heidi Cruz got low interest loans from Goldman Sachs and Citibank that totaled nearly $1 million and then that were paid down later that year.
Yeah.
So basically, This loan doesn't appear in his Senate, in the report that his Senate committee filed, but it does appear in his financial disclosure when he, of his personal financial disclosures right. in the Senate. And it basically means that he got personal loans totaling $1 million that were what funded his Senate campaign and did not disclose it
right.
from Goldman Sachs and Citibank. And Goldman Sachs, by the way, is where his wife works. So this was not.
Yeah.
Just a random coincidence that it was Goldman Sachs. Anyway, yeah. there's no evidence that they, like, got a break on their loans or that there was some sort of, like, illegal shenanigans going right. on with the loans.
One would bet they did.
But one might argue that that's a common sense thing.
Yeah.
But other campaigns have been investigated and fined for failing to make these kinds of disclosures because the disclosures are meant to inform voters about, you know, whether or not their campaigns are getting special treatment from lenders. So right. it's sort of an important transparency thing.
It is.
In any case... Now, it's totally legit to get a loan for your campaign, but you have to disclose it. So his campaign is saying, like, this is no big deal. This is just a trumped-up charge, whatever. Yeah. But it's interesting because he was running on a platform of criticizing the Wall Street bailouts and the influence of big banks in D.C. on a, in a campaign that was being funded by one of those big banks that had gotten a bailout.
Right, that his wife worked for.
That his wife worked for. So... it was, like, the ultimate height of non-transparency hypocrisy. And hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And the reason that he didn't disclose it is obviously because from an optics perspective, it looked horrible.
It looked bad.
Yeah. yeah. What a fucking hypocrite.
God.
Hate Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
Conveniently, a lot of people don't think he should be the president anyway, and yeah. many of them don't think that he can be the president.
25% of Republicans now think.
Also, though, 27% of all voters and 28% of independents think that he should be disqualified as well.
Great.
So a quarter of the country, not just a quarter of Republicans, but a quarter of the whole country, think that he's not qualified to be the president.
Well, I agree.
And this is 47% of the voters surveyed responded that they thought that he was qualified. 26% said they weren't sure, and 27% said that he was not. So the numbers aren't that great. This is a poll, by the way, that was taken between January 7th and January 14th. So it was taken before the debate. So before the most public display of birtherism in the debate.
Yeah.
Obviously, Trump's been attacking him the whole time. But I also saw an op-ed in Washington Post that said that at the time of the writing of the Constitution, natural born was being defined, as were many terms in the Constitution, as they applied to British common law. And British common law defines a natural born citizen as someone who was born in Britain. So, if you use the British common law definition, he isn't a natural-born citizen, which is interesting. He, of course, argues, and we've mentioned this before, that, you know, and this is sort of the other position on that view, that because he qualified for citizenship at birth, that he is a natural-born citizen
right.
because he was an American citizen from birth.
Yeah.
But, in any case, this is an interesting poll. In this poll, people were not only asked about his eligibility, but were also asked generic questions about whether they think that a Canadian-born person could be the president.
Mm.
So, birtherism, coming back to bite him.
There it is.
Coming back to bite Republicans.
That's right. It's what happens when you run against Donald Trump, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah. Or when you're from Canada.
By the way, did you know that super PACs sometimes collude with campaigns?
The horror.
That was a look and noise of shock from Brent Thornburg.
Yeah, a sarcastic one.
A sarcastic shock. You could knock him over with a feather.
I mean, get real, everyone.
Get real.
Like, obviously that's what's going on. We talked about it with David Brock and Hillary Clinton.
And,
like, obviously,
remember,
like,
when Ted Cruz's campaign just dumped a bunch of raw footage
onto
YouTube?
Literally on YouTube, and then...
Somebody had to tell the Super PAC where to find that footage.
Right.
It wasn't like they were just trolling the internet day and night looking for it. They knew it was there.
Right. It was
That's
like hours
colluding.
Worth of footage that his campaign had shot, and now the Super PAC is using in commercials for Ted Cruz.
That's
so,
colluding.
Right.
Even if you do it by dumping raw footage on the internet on a public site, it just means that you can't trace the colluding. It doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Right.
In any case.
Carly Fiorina is going one step further.
Yeah, she's just openly colluding.
She's just sending emails to her Super PAC.
She's openly colluding. There was an investigation by the International Business Times that turned up some evidence that her campaign has been, like, openly coordinating campaign stops with her Super PAC, which is Carly for America, as we recall. This is a direct conflict, according to FEC laws.
Right. But time out really quickly.
Yeah.
Carly for America, remember, you can't use your name in the... We should remind listeners
Carly is
of this.
An acronym.
Carly is an acronym because you can't use your name in your Super PAC because it has to, you know, not obviously, like, supposedly have any ties to you.
So this Super PAC
Carly
is officially called,
like,
C-A-R-L-Y for America.
Right, and C is, like, caring for America or something.
Yeah,
I don't know
America.
What it is. We said on the podcast a long time ago, but... regardless, that's not important to the story. But just so you know how ridiculous super PACs are.
Right, they're Carly that ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah.
In any case, so the New York Times back in September had reported that her campaign had been exploiting a loophole by publishing public Google calendars showing the events that they had planned so that their super PAC could look at them.
Yeah.
And a representative from the super PAC said that the members were just looking at the calendar and showing up. That was just a casual thing that was going on.
Yep.
Totally legal, sort of. But then there was a review of documents that the International Business Times obtained that indicated that it wasn't quite that simple because her PAC was actually organizing these events. So there was a Winthrop University event in South Carolina where PAC staffers corresponded with about the event with university employees and took an advanced tour of the location that they knew to do because they'd been in correspondence with Carly with Carly's actual campaign.
Right.
There was an event at Georgia Tech last month that appears to have been entirely organized by her PAC, according to emails that were provided to IBT from the university itself. Carly for America staffers also provided services that the campaign itself normally would provide, like signing up volunteers and passing out flyers and stuff like that. And how would they get all of this access to her official list and campaign flyers?
It's
because they're colluding with the fucking campaign.
Bingo.
Anyway, according to a former FEC attorney who was interviewed for this story, the activities of the super PAC were in-kind donations. That's forbidden by election law because they're like trade-offs, basically. But since the FEC is notoriously deadlocked because it's got 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats and it's totally slow to act on everything, everyone can just feel free to break the law all they want and they'll never be fined.
Yeah.
So all of this is to say that we know that she's openly colluding with her super PAC and we can't do anything about it.
You know what else we know?
Good work, America.
Is that she's not a person who's going to be president.
This is an irrelevant story. You don't care.
It's relevant.
It's relevant.
In the sense that, like,
in the sense that any campaign could
bonkers,
do this.
And this is another reason to not have super PACs.
Right.
But, like,
Ted Cruz could also do this, by the way.
And then that would potentially
that would
be scarier.
You know who can't do this? Bernie Sanders.
Doesn't have one.
Doesn't have a super PAC. Did it. Anyway. So that's discouraging news that I'm sure we're not surprised to hear that all the...
Oh, I'm sure they're all doing it.
I mean, what is... There
this
is, no,
is just proof that one person is doing it.
There's no such thing as a super PAC that's not colluding with a campaign.
Not.
Like, there's just... That's just not a thing.
It can't be.
That can't be a thing.
No.
I refuse to have that be a thing.
Right.
Anyway, here's some other news that's not related, but I'm equally excited about it.
Thrilled.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz is getting primaried.
Yes!
Debbie Wasserman Schultz has been the sort of whipping boy of this entire Hillary Clinton debacle because she's awful.
Yep.
And she has personally been behind the decisions to limit the number of debates, limit the exposure of other primary challengers in the Democratic debate cycle and the Democratic campaign cycle, and also has been out there telling millennial women to go screw themselves and a bunch of other things that aren't very good.
Yeah.
In any case, because she is such a public figure, the face of the Democratic Party, she is sort of ripe for a challenge because she's a very high-profile Democrat. And someone in Florida decided, you know what? Fuck it. I'll run against her.
And I'm gonna
inspired by feeling the burn.
I was going to say, I'm going to use all of Bernie Sanders' talking points
run
against her.
Timothy Canova, who is a professor at Shepherd Broad College of Law, which is at Florida's Nova Southeastern University, launched a bid last week on a platform that is mostly Bernie Sanders' talking points. He said that Wasserman Schultz's positions on trade, criminal justice, consumer protection, and drug policy reform are evidence that she has sold out to corporate interests.
Well, yes.
At the expense of her constituents.
Yep.
Which, of course, she has. He is vowing to fight Obama's trade agenda with the TPP. He's working on criminal justice, big banks. He's talking about big banks and money in politics.
Yeah.
He is a former aide to a representative from Massachusetts. So he's basically, he's got a background in politics.
Oh, yeah, Paul Tsongas. Paul Tsongas ran for president.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So he's got a background in politics. He's a Florida person, though.
Yeah.
And has basically been going around saying that he wishes someone else would step up, but no one is. So he thought, I better do it.
Yeah.
He's saying that Wasserman Schultz is a bad fit for the district because of a few specific things. A few votes that she took. She fought against new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau guidelines governing car loans and payday lenders. She opposed a referendum in Florida in 2014 that would legalize medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
He called her a drug warrior in the pocket of the private prison industry. Promotes incarcerations.
Yep.
She was also someone who voted to fast-track the TPP.
Yeah, of course.
And he said that that would be an environmental catastrophe for South Florida. So, in any case, basically, she's now getting dinged for her public role in how terrible everything is turning out in this presidential race, ultimately.
Couldn't be more
and
excited
about
that. And
also, we're sort of getting to see the fallout of what it is to require sitting Democrats to serve on these campaign committees.
Yeah.
Because, basically, in being this public figure within the DNC, or this public leader of the DNC, she's not really able to ever vote against the Obama administration's agenda.
Yeah.
So she can't really make votes on the basis of what her constituents want.
Right.
She can only really vote on the basis of what the party's platform as a whole is because right. of her position. So he's sort of saying, this is not who we want representing us.
Yeah.
But in any case, that's exciting because Debbie Wasserman Schultz is on our list.
Yeah.
And Debbie Wasserman Schultz should be getting primaried the role that she's just playing in destroying Democratic politics.
And it's also time, I think it's long past time that Democrats use primaried as a verb.
He's basically
as well.
Tea partying her.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know what?
Like, let's do it.
Fine. You know who had too much of a voice in all of the last election cycles? The Tea Party.
That's right.
You know who got to determine the Republican agenda? The Tea Party.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. If that's how we're going to play politics, then let's have our
let's
own crazy fringe. Why not?
Boom. I'm into it.
Being rational is only making us compromise to the right.
Yeah.
I'm sick of that.
Screw that.
Sick of it. Yeah. In any case.
Oh, boy.
Now we need to talk about something that we probably should have talked about every day for the last million months.
Yeah.
But we're finally getting right
because
to it.
Because this is sort of like the worst of...
This is something that the reason that we can't talk about it is because it's not funny.
Exactly.
But we have to talk about
it. There's nothing humorous about the Flint water situation right now. At
it's
all.
It's just fucking terrible.
Yeah. Even in our rundown, we were trying to think of something joke-like to
right.
write.
And there was
we were
nothing
like,
to
well,
say.
Well, it's not there.
This
so
is just an unacceptable situation.
Yeah, exactly.
So basically, yesterday, Saturday, Obama declared a state of emergency finally in
right.
Flint.
After the governor asked him to do so, even though he's known about it
for
fucking
two years. The governor's known
and
about it for 2 years.
Hasn't done a damn thing.
Yeah. So here's just quick background on what's going on in case you haven't been following the story.
Yeah.
In April of 2014, Flint switched to a new water supply that was coming from the Flint
River.
It was to save money. They have some of the highest water costs in the country in Flint. In the years following, they got tons of complaints from people about the fact that the water source was clearly contaminated. And it was because the new supply was salty and it was flowing through corroded pipes. And so it was pulling lead into the system.
If you've seen pictures of the water,
it's
by the
yellow.
Way, it's yellow.
It's a color that is not the right color for water.
For water, correct. Yeah.
The clues started immediately. People were complaining about the smell of the water, the discoloration of the water, the taste of the water.
Yeah.
In October of 2014, a GM plant that's one of the few that's still located over there stopped using the water because parts were becoming rusted.
I mean.
Then tests of the water revealed there were elevated levels of a lot of chemical compounds in the water supply that can lead to liver and kidney disease. And then research started to show that the elevated lead levels were in the blood, that there were elevated lead levels in the blood of local children. There was suddenly an increase in Legionnaire's disease.
Ten people have died of Legionnaire's disease.
Which is like a very extreme pneumonia. And many scientists, when they heard about what was happening, said that this was something they would be not surprised to find.
Yeah.
So while there hasn't been a study to link the two, scientists predicted that this would happen in response to what they were finding. And through all of this, officials were downplaying the residents' concern and disputing research that was coming out and saying that the water was safe to drink.
This yellow water is fine. Just
vehemently
hold on,
insisting that the water was safe to drink.
Yeah.
Then in October, Rick Snyder finally admitted that the situation was actually fucking awful.
Yeah.
And then announced a plan to transfer Flint back to its previous water supply.
Yeah.
But finally, this week, the White House was called in to put FEMA on the case. Because
FEMA came in, Rick Snyder had called up the National Guard to literally go door to door and hand out bottles of water.
They literally cannot drink the water.
They can't
right
drink
now
the water. They have no water.
They have no water. So FEMA has to go in and give them water.
You can't bathe in it either.
No, you can't bathe in it. Residents were talking about how it made them itchy to bathe in it. Like, that's horrible to think about. But also, they're going to have this whole secondary wave of issues because they're going to be all these kids who had extreme lead poisoning as children, which, as you know, causes mental impairments. It causes physical health impairments.
Right, exactly.
I mean, that's something that we have tried to regulate and paint years ago because we knew about this. In any case, Rick Snyder's been under fire for his handling of this situation because he knew about this crisis for a long time. And the government there was not just ignoring it. They were denying it was happening this whole time.
They were aware
that it was happening, and they were vehemently denying that there was a problem.
Well, they didn't care that it was a problem for poor black people.
Exactly. Because Flint is one of the poorest cities in America. It's one of the most dangerous cities in America. It's a city with a large minority population.
Yeah, it's a class and race issue.
It's a class and race issue. They were literally just ignoring them because they didn't care about the people in Flint.
They didn't care.
In any case, Snyder had also apparently requested at this point that we get that they designate it a major disaster declaration, or major disaster, which is something for natural disasters that they did not get from the Obama administration. But I feel like at this point he's just trying to point fingers at things that other people aren't doing because he's in a lot of hot water.
Well, people are calling for his resignation.
People are calling for his resignation.
I would not call for his resignation so much as I would call for his arrest.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean like, that's criminal.
It's criminal. I mean, he should be charged for either
manslaughter.
I was going to say murder, but or, you know, yeah. whatever, you know, being somehow like involved in that. I mean, like yeah. people are dying here and he knew about it yeah. and he didn't do anything about
no.
it.
I mean, and this is, I mean, criminal. As we said this in the rundown, this is an extension of state violence against Black people.
It totally is.
This is a part of state violence against Black people.
Yeah.
This, knowing that there is a public health risk that you are not addressing that is actively becoming a public health disaster
right.
is state violence.
Yes,
because you are the only people with the ability to fix it.
Yes. And when you're not doing it because of the fact that it's in Flint.
Yeah.
It's, you know, as one of the moments where I felt like Hillary Clinton sort of did it tonight at yeah. the debate, was she said if a wealthy suburb of Detroit was having the same issues, right. then this would have been solved long ago.
So true.
And she's absolutely right.
Yeah. No, that's I think, you know, this is an issue that I have some experience with because this is sort of similar to what happened 9/11. After 9/11.
Sure.
This is the issue that I work on all the time
yeah.
is the government in lying to residents about the safety of the totally. Air, the water, or whatever it is
yeah.
in the neighborhood that they live in or work in or go to school in.
Yeah.
This is, so it's something that I sort of have like a very personal, you know, I feel like I have a very personal response to what's going on here. I'm like not just like angry about this. I feel like this is criminal.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of liberals feel that way as well. Anyway,
yeah.
but I'm yeah. this is criminal because any time that you are being lied to by the government, the health impacts of that are on them.
Totally.
It's no longer, you don't have the ability to make an adult decision to not subject yourself to a hazard if someone is lying to you about what the right. hazard is.
Well, you don't have anything to do. I mean, like, what? It's your
children,
water, so what are you supposed
well, exactly.
to do? You can't
and
not, I mean.
Children in Flint are even less able to make these decisions for
totally.
Themselves because they are children, so they are not able to decide where they live and what water they drink and
right.
all of these things. This, if they don't have a health program for these people, like,
yeah.
in way less time than what it took to pass health, you know, health care for 9/11,
yeah.
the 9/11 community, I'm going to be really fucking angry about
yeah.
that because this
well,
is
you should be.
This is unacceptable. In
yeah.
any case, the Bernie Sanders has called for his resignation.
Yep.
Michael Moore, by the way, don't piss off Mike. Don't piss off the city that Michael Moore was born in.
I know,
Michael
yeah.
Moore is from Flint.
Right.
Roger and Me is about Flint.
And he can drum up social media
like very
you know,
few other
anger like few people. Yeah,
yeah.
exactly.
So
yeah.
this is stupid anyway because even though the residents of Flint are poor and Black, Michael Moore is also a former resident of Flint.
yeah.
Like don't be the idiots who didn't see this coming.
yeah, exactly.
But this is just sort of like the Flint ish. This is just insult added to injury for Flint because Flint has been put through the economic ringer.
Yeah.
GM left Flint. It sort of has a Detroit-like issue where
yeah.
the major industry there left, and so there were no jobs and no one came in to rescue them, and so the economy has just been in free fall for years.
Yeah.
It is routinely rated as one of the most dangerous cities in America, and that is largely because not only is it extremely poor, but they can't the tax base doesn't support having a large enough police department, so they can't police it.
Right.
And there's a huge unemployment rate there. There's a huge underemployment rate there. I mean, like, it's already a fucking disaster over in Flint.
Yeah.
They are, and they have some of the highest water bills in the country, which is even more annoying. Like, don't.
Right.
Blah.
Yeah, especially when it's killing you.
Yeah, especially when it's killing you. In any case, the runaround that they got is similar to what happened after 9/11, so I can tell them from experience that it's really fucking annoying.
yes.
And also to not accept no's.
Yeah.
You know,
for sure.
it's
yeah.
this is going to be hard because this is a disenfranchised population that's going to
yeah.
have to ask for these services, and that's really not fair. We should just provide them.
Yeah.
We shouldn't make them come and ask because you at least had, after 9/11, you had a disenfranchised population. You had the residents of Chinatown and the Lower East Side. You had, you know, but you also had unions. You had the Tribeca
right.
residents who were able to organize on this issue. They don't
right.
even have
they
that in
have
Flint.
That. Yep.
So this is like, we shouldn't make them come
yeah,
ask for help.
I was going to say, there's nobody to organize
There's no
for
one
them.
To organize for them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, God bless them if they can organize amongst themselves.
Yeah.
But it's we shouldn't make them do that.
No, I agree. Yeah.
In any case.
In final news...
Happy Martin Luther King Day tomorrow, today, whenever you're listening to this.
Right.
If you are in Arkansas, Mississippi, or Alabama, go die in a well, Robert E. Lee Day.
Yes. That's a thing. Did you
guys,
know this?
You guys, this is crazy. Okay.
It's a
joint
holiday.
That on the third Monday of January, we all celebrate Martin Luther King Day.
Yes.
Some of us are not getting the day off. I would argue that that's not fair.
I am, which is shocking.
But, I know. There's rarely been a day that Brent has gotten off and I haven't.
Yeah.
In any case, in Arkansas, Mississippi, and Alabama, on the very same day that we celebrate Martin Luther King Day, so that is the day that we celebrate civil rights,
yes,
they are celebrating Robert E. Lee Day, a day that they're celebrating
slavery.
Supporting slavery. Martin Luther King and Robert E. Lee's birthdays are 4 days apart.
Sure.
Now, that's not a conundrum for me, because I would never think of having a Robert E. Lee Day.
No, you don't need one.
I don't need one.
Martin Luther King probably was 4 days apart from
a lot of people that don't need a day.
In history that don't have to have a day that
correct.
He shares
correct.
With.
Or
at all.
In Arkansas in particular, though, this tradition has come under some fire because people are like, this is straight up nonsense.
Yeah.
Like, that's the height of shenanigans. So, having a civil rights hero celebrated as the same day as the man who fought to preserve slavery is something we shouldn't do.
Yeah.
So, Asa Hutchinson, who's the governor in Arkansas,
right.
has been pushing to separate the joint holiday because, duh. Because,
right.
obviously. But
like, also,
here's
just do away with that one.
Like, yeah, here's what's interesting. In Arkansas, they started celebrating Robert E. Lee Day in the 40s, and then they started celebrating Martin Luther King Day in 1983.
Oh, gosh.
And then, in 1985, they were like, let's just do it on the same day.
Oh, boy.
So, they had years to consider what they wanted to do about these multiple holidays in
right.
January, and to choose the right answer. And instead,
right.
in 1985, they chose
the wrong answer.
So, in January of last year, lawmakers in Arkansas defeated a bill that would have reserved the third Monday in January as Martin Luther King Day, and established a holiday for Robert E. Lee in November that was not an official holiday, like government holiday, but was just sort of like a celebratory day.
Yeah.
The residents of Arkansas did not stand for that. They were like, no, we want to celebrate Robert E. Lee. If we get rid of his day, his holiday will be less important than Martin Luther King Day, which is as it should be.
Correct.
So in any case, Hutchinson wants lawmakers to pass legislation that gives Martin Luther King his own day. But it seems like it might not happen. And that is a reflection on why we shouldn't trust the judgment of anybody in Arkansas. Because apparently they're terrible.
Yeah.
I would argue that even having a Robert E. Lee Day is not really commemorating the history of Arkansas as much as it's like commemorating a straight-up traitor.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost
yes.
like
yes.
that is like a traitorous activity to celebrate the opposition
yes.
to the U.S. government as we know it in a civil war
yes.
that we had.
Yep.
I mean... That's
come on.
That's like celebrating ISIS. Like,
yeah.
That's like if we were like, that guy in San Bernardino was a hero, so we'll celebrate him. Like, that's not... He was a traitor.
That's right.
It's like celebrating Clive and Bundy's family.
Yes.
It's just like that.
Let's not do that.
Let's not do that.
Do you see people were sending them bags of dicks,
by the way? That was the greatest.
Yeah.
I know.
And then they complained about it, so somebody sent them lube. Did you see that?
No, I didn't see that.
That happened.
God, people are so funny on the internet sometimes.
They really are. Sometimes the internet can be a dark place, but also it can
really
come through for you sometimes.
Yes, it's come together for the greater good when it comes to humor time and again.
Yeah.
Today at the debate party, everyone was like, what are you guys doing on your phones?
I know.
We were like, Twitter, friends.
Twitter.
And what's surprising, because it is so exciting to watch a Bernie Sanders performance while you're on Twitter, because there's so much excitement about him on Twitter.
A lot of burn feeling.
They were missing 50% of the excitement of that whole experience.
I know, by not looking at their phones.
That was one time that it was okay to be in
they
public looking
at your
phone.
They thought they were focusing, but they weren't.
They weren't.
They were focusing on the wrong thing.
They were focusing on the wrong thing, exactly. The conversation was happening while it was going on, and it was glorious.
Yeah.
In any case, that's
an
this
hour
week
and 45
in news.
Minute
that's
podcast.
2 hours of news
but it was,
for you.
The best an hour and 45 minutes you're going to spend this week.
Correct.
I guarantee you.
Correct. This gives you two commutes to,
yeah, exactly.
to listen to our glorious, our beautiful voices.
That's right.
Yes. In any case, we will be back next week, possibly only for an hour, possibly for 7 hours. We don't
possibly
know what's going to happen.
I might be just as angry next week.
Yeah. We might have to do another 30-minute segment on how much we hate Hillary Clinton next week.
Yep.
That's what happens.
Yep.
But until then, be good.
Have a good week.
Have a good week. Tell your friends to vote.
Don't celebrate Robert E. Lee Day tomorrow.
And do not
today.
Celebrate Robert E. Lee Day. It's so easy to not do
just
it.
Don't.
Just don't do it.
Yep.
If people ask you what holiday you're celebrating, you can say
MLK.
Martin Luther King Day.
Yeah.
And that's the answer. Boom. In any case, until next week.
Bye.
Bye.